informative radio for the Sunshine State.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
Is run. For 24 hours each year, men and machines are put to the supreme test, speed and stamina. There are 55 cars and 110 drivers, representing countries from all over the world. They will drive day and night through sun and rain. Beneath his racing suit, each driver must wear fireproof underwear, capable of withstanding 2,400 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature of burning gasoline, for 15 seconds. Yellow flags and yellow lights along the circuit indicate the presence of an accident. Yellow means danger, no overtaking. And so, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the most famous motor car race in the world, the 38th running of the Grand Prix of Endurance and Efficiency, the 24 hours.
Le Mans. The essence is speed. The objective is winning, and the danger is dying. Le Mans, where hour by hour, lap after lap, the man-to-man competition of champions never stops.
Do you think it will be like a Nürburgring, a race between you and Staller?
I hope not.
Will this be the same kind of race you had with Delaney at the Nürburgring?
Well, this is Le Mans. It's a different thing, you know.
And what do you think of Staller?
Staller? I think he's probably one of the best drivers in the world.
Do you think that you and Delaney will end up having a close race here?
Maybe. He's fast, I'm fast, so we're always together.
Press is making a big thing about us.
Yeah. But it's money.
That's American.
Michael? Be careful.
Now, don't be a pain in the ass, Harry.
Le Mans. At 200 miles an hour, the pressure of winning and losing is tough enough. Explaining it to someone else makes it even tougher.
This isn't just a 1,000-to-1 shot. This is a professional blood sport. And it can happen to you. And then it can happen to you again.
What is so important about driving faster than anyone else?
A lot of people go through life doing things badly. Racing's important to men who do it well. When you're racing, it's life. Anything that happens before or after, it's just waiting.
Le Mans. The men. The machines. The motion picture. Steve McQueen stars in it. No one else could.
This is Matt Stone here at Amelia Island, and you are listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computers and Google Tantalk1340.com, and you can see us live here in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com. We can find out all about us, and if you've missed any of our past shows, don't forget to check out Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and you can listen to all 720 shows. Well, guess what, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, sports fans, race car guys, we got part two with Erich Glavica, who was the stunt coordinator and one of the stunt drivers in the movie Le Mans, the Steve Quinn movie, and he was also the stunt coordinator and one of the stunt drivers and the stunt double for Diana Riggs in the James Bond film On Your Majesty's Secret Service. But before we get into the show, I'm going to talk a little bit about a couple of the upcoming events. The end of the month here, we got a big show up in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh. It's called the Pittsburgh Grand Prix. One of the interesting events there, besides the vintage races and all the car gatherings and everything, is the reunion of the Ford GT40. And we had Lance Stander on from Superformance here a couple of weeks ago. And we also had Mark Piloch on. Both those are huge Ford GT collectors. Of course, Lance is the owner of Superformance. And, of course, they build reproduction Ford GTs, GT40s, actually. And then also we've got the Shelby American SAC 49. It takes place in New Jersey. That's at the end of the month. And then, of course, the big event here coming up in a few weeks is the Monterey Collector Car Week. Now, besides all the auctions, speaking of auctions, Mecum was just this past weekend, and we were over there hanging out with the guys from Mecum. But there will be a number of auctions during Monterey Collector Car Week, most notably Mecum, RM, Gooding & Company, and Bonhams. Those are the biggies that'll be there. Be some interesting cars at some of these auctions, naturally. And then, of course, you have the Haggerty Hangar Party, and then you've got the Quail, which is on Friday. That's a huge collector car gathering, very exclusive, very interesting cars that show up there at that event. You've got Legends of the Autobahn, which is on Thursday, which is all German cars, Porsches, obviously, Volkswagens, Audis, NSUs, BMWs, Mercedes, and so on. On Friday, you also have the Porsche Works Reunion, and there'll probably be a few thousand Porsches roaming around there. Of course, they'll be roaming all over Monterey because, you know, California and Porsches are kind of like synonymous. In fact, one of the first Porsche dealerships / Porsche Volkswagen, I should say, that was in the Monterey Peninsula area was Wester, I think. In fact, I've been looking for a Wester license plate frame that has both the VW and the Porsche crest on it because they're kind of collectible. Anyway, well, I guess you caught the beginning of the show where I played the intro to the 1971 movie Le Mans, produced by Steve McQueen, starring Steve McQueen, of course, and, of course, our upcoming guest here, Eric Glavitsa. So what we're going to do is we're going to play a little music here, then we're going to be right back with our interview and our special guest for the evening. So don't touch that dial. We'll be right back. You're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Five-time Le Mans winner, three-time Daytona 24-hour winner, two-time World Sports Car champion. You're listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
All right. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, sports fans, car guys, everybody like that. It's time to have part two with our good friend, stunt driver, part-time actor, author, Eric Glavitsa, who is probably best known as being one of the stunt drivers, stunt coordinators, and stunt doubles in James Bond movie On Her Majesty's Secret Service and the movie Le Mans with Steve McQueen. Eric, welcome back to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. How are you doing this evening?
Hi, great. Sunshine in Vienna.
Sunshine in Vienna. Okay. Well, anyway, so Eric, the last time we had you on the show, we were talking a little bit about some of the stuff you were doing in the movie Le Mans. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Steve McQueen. He was a very interesting guy. Was he very private or was he kind of social?
Very difficult, actually, to say, because, I mean, there was a big difference in his behavior, let's put it that way, between the film society and the stunt drivers or the drivers at all. Yeah, because to us, he was very friendly. We could have everything from him. For example, one Thursday, I was asking him, I have a race in Vienna. Is it possible that I can stay over the weekend in Vienna to fly to Vienna? No problem, no problem. So he organized a helicopter for me, to fly me from Le Mans Friday in the afternoon to Orly. At that time, the Gaulle Airport wasn't ready. Orly Airport in Paris. There they dropped me, so I went into the Austrian airline aeroplane, and they thought he is coming, the president of Austria, and I could fly to Vienna. And I had about 5 or 8 races, something I have to do in Switzerland and in Austria. And for me, no problem to leave the set.
Interesting.
And so he was very understanding the racing business. You know?
So back to the movie now. You had kind of you were talking last week when we had you on the show. You were talking about how Steve McQueen had an issue with the other producers because they wanted to make the movie, you know, Hollywood, and he wanted the movie more about the car, the racing, what actually goes on, what actually transpires during a 24-hour race.
So how did you
and some of the other actors feel about that? Were they all on board with that? Did they see what Steve McQueen was trying to achieve there? Because the movie actually does depict it's a good representation of what actually goes on during racing.
That's right. Yeah, with the other actors were actually very, very fed up.
Oh, they are. Were too, really?
You know, this is a special society where I was light years away from them. I was a young driver just thinking about girls and fast cars, and that was it. And for us, Steve was very helpful. Whatever we wanted, we got from Steve. But I know that in the first set, the real actors from England, Sweden, France, Germany, they got very often crossed up with Steve, because he wanted to change this, he wanted to change that. No, you're not coming. So you know where the pits are in Le Mans, the old pits. Now it's completely changed. The old pits, you were going like to catacomb. It was very dark. And there they were shooting, you know, when Steve was pointing at the Ferrari driver at Sigi Rauch. So they were shooting very often in them, and the other actors, they were very fed up because they were just hanging around and nobody knew what was going to happen. Even the script start today, you know, wait, what action is going to be? There were no dialects, nothing in there, you know? And there was an atmosphere which was, to say at least, very complicated, especially when John Sturges was getting out, you know? Because at that time, everybody thought that the films are over. And I remember when Steve then decided to continue, I mean, that he's getting no money and he will continue, then the French union started to get crossed up with the film people. And at that time, I remember, it's now just popping up into my head, that the whole American camera crew, the whole American guys who were working in this film business, were flying home, and they were changed with French cameramen and French people, you know, for the electricity and the lights and everything. And everybody knew at that time, in the end of '60s, that the French were speaking terrible English, actually no English. And everybody knows, I mean, how friendly the Americans are, you know, when nobody speaks English. I mean, they were shouting at each other. I mean, they were really a very, very bad atmosphere for months. At the end, it became a little bit more peaceful. But at that time, then Steve McQueen got crossed up with Bob. What was his name? With the producers who actually they were all friends, close friends together. And they were working before in the Bullet movie. And after these films, the whole group was crossed up. They didn't, you know, Lee Katzin didn't play. Well, Lee Katzin then came to Vienna when I invited him to stay a couple of days with me in Vienna because he was completely down. But he was swimming in whiskey. And, you know, the atmosphere was very negative. There's a big difference between, of course, the film society, the film people, the real people, cameraman, and the makeup people and all these guys, and our society, and us drivers, because we were completely free. You know, when someone had a special request, he said, okay, no problem. Now, if some of the actors special request, now he shouted with him. You know? So you can imagine how the grammar was. Mm. And by the end of the film in November, he was completely crossed up with his old friends from Bullet.
Interesting.
Yeah, they were all gone.
When you mentioned... You mentioned early that Sturgis wanted a script.
Yeah.
And Solar Productions, which is Steve McQueen's company, was basically the production company that did that. So did Steve McQueen actually have a script for the movie that he had written and then proposed
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. So
absolutely
he was
nothing. Yeah. I have still a friend, you know, he was at that time very young. He now lives in Hollywood, and I'm visiting him when I'm there. Pete Samuelson, he was at that time 20 years old. And he said, the funny thing is, when we went out for shooting for the day, the script was completely empty. And Steve was standing there, you know, with some optical in his eyes. And he was like, okay, the cars are coming here full speed. And then it was lunchtime, then we were all going back. And so in the afternoon, we went there, you know, with 30 cars, you must imagine, racing cars. These were the racing cars who raced actually at the actual race in this year in June.
Wow.
And this were the three Ferraris, this were the two John Wire Porsche from John Wire Racing Team. This was the Burks 917 from Stuttgart. It was and race cars, you cannot equalize, race cars is not a Ford Mustang. You just get in, you start the engine, you go there, and then you stop, you go for a coffee, and then you drive home. The racing car, there's always to be warmed up. And then when he's standing too long, then the engine starts to blow up and cooking. The racing tires are only working in a certain temperature range. When the cars are standing too long, then the racing tires are like with ordinary tires on snow. Yeah? So you can imagine it was nearly every day there was chaotic.
Interesting.
Cows.
So when did the production actually start? Because the 24-hour Le Mans is usually what? It's in June, right?
And in June,
Okay. So and we obviously we just had that a couple weeks ago in Le Mans. Yeah. And back then, and by the way, the Team Austria won 1970. Since you are Austrian and I'm Austrian, so
yeah,
österreichische Meisterschaft and Nummer 23 Porsche 917, anyway, then rot-weiß. Anyway, so did the production, the actually filming start before the June 24-hour Le Mans and then take a break and then continue afterwards? Because
that's right.
Of the footage in the movie from the actual Le Mans event that took place in, because I was told that's true, that some of the footage, they actually did some filming during the actual 24-hour race and put that in the movie.
Yeah. Steve McQueen's 908, if you know, Steve McQueen's own 908 Porsche was in the race with Jonathan Williams and some German driver, I forgot his name, but maybe it's coming, I see him in front of him. But it was Jonathan Williams, a close friend of mine. And then it was not Krieger. I forgot his name. But, they put this car in the race, have a camera in front mounted.
Yeah.
In front, shooting forward, and one camera behind, shooting backward. And the thing was that the organizer said, okay, this car can drive in the race, but it has to qualify. And Williams qualified the car. It was not the problem because the 908 is fast enough car. So they had it in the race. But every 10 minutes, this car has to come into the pits to change the film rules.
Uh-huh.
And still it finished because at the real race, there were only six cars finishing. Only six cars. There were one deadly accident from Jackie X. I think he hit a marshal around midnight, and many accidents by the Ferrari crew. All works Ferraris, three or four, were out. And, to make the story short, there were only six cars finishing in the race.
Including?
And this was Hans Herrmann and Dick Edward in the Porsche 917.
Yeah.
And second was another Porsche 917 with Willy Kausen, but the other driver, I don't know. Third was Marco in the Porsche 908. But many laps back, and so, because it was a catastrophic race. And nowadays, they're finished 40 cars, but only six cars finishing.
Was there bad weather? Was there rain? What was going on? Nothing?
Yes, usually, yes. Around midnight, I think, when I remember right, around 11 o'clock before midnight, it started to rain, heavy rain. Then interrupted without no rain, then rain coming again, and Le Mans is always very. It's very rare that there's no rain within 24 hours. And this year was rain again.
Okay, so now tell us about some of the other stunt drivers. Were there other racing, well-known racing drivers that were also used as stunt drivers? I believe we talked about once before. Derek Bell was in there, and Vic Elford. Who are some of the other well-known race car drivers that actually drove in the movie Le Mans?
But they were not involved in the accidents.
They were not involved in the accidents, no.
They were just the driving. This was, when I remember, this was Derek Bell. This was Mike Parks. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mike Parks, yeah. He got killed in a road accident in Italy, Mike Parks. Then was Mike Hailwood, because I was very close with Mike, and every day we were together. David Piper, he had the big accident in September or October where he lost his leg.
Yeah, and Lola, I think he was driving, right? Lola?
No, this was happening in a Porsche 917.
Oh, in a Porsche
917. Lower wishbone was breaking, because I remember I was in the group. Lower wishbone broke, and the car slid to the guardrail. It was cut in two.
Oh.
In the middle, and the front end was flying on the inside, and the engine way. It was terrible, actually. David was very, very lucky. And Mike Hailwood, David Piper, Mike Parks, Jonathan Williams, Martin Gregory, the US driver, because I was pretty close to him, because Martin Gregory was buying himself a racing bicycle. It was playing around every day with that racing bicycle. Because I got from Steve McQueen the Husqvarna 400 motocross bike.
Oh, yeah?
And I've never been on a bike before. I got this bike and started from then a motocross career, which lasted until 1982.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you got Steve McQueen's Husky 400. Okay, that's good.
Yes,
that's good.
Yes. They flew in a Learjet. They flew in a Learjet, the Husky 400, from Husqvarna, from Sweden, down to Le Mans.
No kidding.
In a Learjet. It landed, I think it's 4 o'clock in the morning, on this little airstrip behind the racetrack. And Steve was riding a little bit around, and I was watching him. And I was thinking, I just watch him. to see how he's going to crash. Because I didn't know that he was a good motorbike rider. I had nothing to do with motorcycles until that time. And then suddenly he stopped near me and he said, do you want to try? But he stopped the engine, and I was not able to kickstart this engine. So I said an excuse and I went away. And then some days later, he was always riding again, and I was passing with my car and stopped, watched him, and then he stopped by me and let the engine run and said, do you want to try it? Oh, okay. And I thought, well, this motorbike is going to kill me. You know? Uh-huh. And to my luck, Mike Haywood, you know, 9-time world champion of motorcycles, he was explaining me how to ride it.
Uh-huh.
You must sit much forward and do this, and he had the leg out in the corner, and he was very patient with me because I was a complete idiot. And the bacillus just caught my head. And from then on, I became a motocross rider. I practiced because I had a lot of time,
uh-huh.
you know, in filming. Besides the director and his team, everybody has a lot of time. And this is the reason why all I ending up as alcoholic. So I had this motorcycle and I was practicing every day. And it was getting better and better. And then one of the, I think, German Porsche mechanics, he was an ex-motocross rider. And he taught me a lot.
Uh-huh.
And then I brought this bike back home and found a friend here in Vienna who was a motocross rider. He was practicing here in near Sittendorf, outside of Vienna, in the snow we were practicing, and I was completely maniac. I was completely sick. I was training nearly every day. I did all the push-ups and this stuff. And then in April, I did my first motocross race. And I raced this bike until the end of 71. And then I gave it back to Husqvarna because at that time I was getting better and better. And then they gave me a contract. He gave me a 250 and I gave him my 400. But please don't ask me now, where is Steve McQueen's Husqvarna 400? Because everybody asks me.
Oh, and man.
Yes, I know. But I'm too stupid. I don't know where this bike is. Yeah, they gave me a 250 works bike, and then, you know, and then I changed my business from 1971. I became von Kawasaki general distributor of Austria.
Uh-huh.
So I opened up the distributorship, and then from 1973, I think, I was then riding a Kawasaki works bike and so on.
Interesting. Let's go.
And I stopped in 1982 when I suddenly found out that the other riders became so friendly to me. And I was wondering why. And then I saw that they are flirting with my daughter.
Oh.
So that was the time to call it a day.
Call it a day.
Then I quit.
All right, let's go back to the races. So tell us about some of the crashes and the stunts that you had to do in there. Oh, wait a minute. Let's talk a little bit about Jochen Rindt, because Jochen, you were trying to get Jochen Rindt, your good friend, and one of my my all-time favorite race car drivers, to be one of the co-drivers in the movie. And what happened?
He was a born race driver. Yeah, no, I met him in February. In February 1970, I met him in the coffee shop at Konditorei near the Graben in the center of Vienna. And I was telling him, about the money I earned from the James Bond film, because you must imagine at that time, the Formula One drivers actually got nothing. Yeah, they got, $2,000-$3,000 when they were winning a Formula One race or something like this. And when I told him how much I earned from the James Bond film, he was asking me whether he could also get some job in the film business. And then I asked Steve McQueen, and I remember that Steve said, oh, great, oh, the guy with the nose, you know, the famous nose from Jochen.
Yeah.
And I was calling Jochen, but Walter Hayes from Ford Motor Company, because at that time, the promotion business started to grow.
Right.
Now, 4 years before, everybody could do what he wants. But at the end of the 60s, the promotion began to rise. And Jochen said, I was discussing it, but Walter Hayes wouldn't like it. I remember him. And Walter Hayes, you know, he was the president of Ford, the second year Henry Ford. No?
Uh-huh.
And he didn't, because Walter Hayes knew that this film is a Porsche promotion thing.
Uh-huh.
Because PS just supplied us with everything we wanted. And what everyone wanted, PS said yes. So this was a big, and of course the Porsche had to win in the film, in the movie.
Okay.
And so Jochen did that, and then he started his races, Formula One season, and in September 5th, he got killed in Monza.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
Well, he was, you know, obviously he won the 65 Le Mans race in the Ferrari, but, yeah, you know, he was a very well-known driver, and just like you said, Jochen Rindt, who was also good friends with Jackie Stewart, but he
yes,
and
very
you knew it,
close,
and,
very close.
And he was German Austrian because his dad was German and his mom was Austrian, right? If I remember the story correctly, but he raced under an Austrian.
Jochen was German. He had a German passport. He was born in Germany in Mainz.
Yeah,
and had the German citizenship. It's only typically Austrian. You know, when they like, they make. Out of Beethoven, they make an Austrian composer. And Jochen was only because his parents got killed in 1943 at the bombing raid in Hamburg. And then he was at that time, by coincidence, he was in Bad Ischl
okay.
with his grandfather. And then, of course, the parents were gone. And then he was staying... until he was 20 years old in Graz.
In Austria.
But he was a German citizen. They had a German passport or so.
Okay. But his mother was Austrian, right?
Yes. The funny thing is, what Jochen and I always were laughing about, his mother was Austrian, the father German. My mother was German and my father was Austrian.
Interesting.
Yes, my mother was coming during the Nazi years because my father was quite a top manager in steel production at Berla in Kapfenberg, and during a visit from German people, because Berla in Kapfenberg was a main weapon in industry. And they were visiting in, and so my mother met my father, and you know, and the story went on.
Okay. All right, let's go back to the movie. All right, so in the movie, So Jochen didn't get the role. Meanwhile, you're back there doing stunts. So during the actual filming, are you guys actually getting up to speed? Are you going over 200 miles an hour in these cars on the Mulsanne Strait?
Yes, 300. You know, you only know the speed when you look at this diagram, and you look at the sixth gear, how many revs, and then you find out this was 380 kilometers an hour. No? But when you drive, you don't have a speedometer in the car. You only have a
tachometer,
just for the revs per minute and the oil pressure and temperature and stuff like this. No? And the only thing you can look, you go in the sixth gear flat out, or in the fifth gear flat out, and you say, okay, how many revs? 8,500 or 8,800, and you look at the diagram when you're back in the pits, and you said, oh, 375 kilometers an hour. But you don't feel it that way, you know, because you're coming out at this corner into the straight to Unadier, and you just go up with the gears, bam, 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 fast, bam, bam, and you just aim the car in the middle of the track.
Did the so what were some of the cars that you drove during the filming of the movie?
The 917 I was driving only one time.
Okay.
Sometimes I was driving the 512 Ferrari.
Yeah.
And then quite often the 312. This was the with the 3-liter 12-cylinder Ferrari with a Formula One engine in there. And these cars belonged actually to the NART team, the North American Racing Team.
Oh, to Chinetti.
Yeah.
Chinetti's right. Cars. Okay.
Yeah. He was there.
Chinetti was?
Yeah. He was quite for a long time. He was there running around in sunglasses. I remember him, and he called me Kit. I remember. Kit, let's have some lunch.
What was Chinetti like? Was he a pretty likable guy?
The thing is that for me, also the racing drivers, all the American racing drivers and racing people, they're very likable guys.
Uh-huh.
I even met, Richard Petty.
Oh, really?
You know, the NASCAR guys, yes, later on in the years, you know, I met him. And they were arrogant, actually, were much more the Europeans, especially in the 60 years.
Uh-huh.
And the French drivers, very, very arrogant. The German drivers, I mean, Gerhard Mitter, you could hardly speak to him, you know. More very, very friendly was Dan Gurney, Phil Hill, Reggie Ginter. No, I met him. I even met Dan Gurney much years later, I think in the 90s, in his American Eagle shop in Santa Ana in Los Angeles. I stopped there for a couple of times for some coffee, and he was very unbelievably friendly. Mm. Also, Carroll Shelby.
Oh, wow, good.
Yeah, very, very friendly. I mean, against Hoschke Hanschen, he was an arrogant idiot, you know.
How about Hans Hermann?
Yeah, Hans Hermann.
Oh.
But he was very quiet, actually.
Was he?
I like very much Rolf Stommelen.
Okay.
We were very close. You know, Hans Hermann was older than me. I mean, he was born somewhere in the 20s.
Uh-huh.
And I was in the 60s, and I was looking for the girls. But Rolf Stommelen, I was very close to Rolf. And when he got killed in the Riverside, you know, it really broke my heart. Because he already stopped racing. You know, he already stopped racing. And Fitzgerald team in the Porsche, I think they lost the second driver to Derek Bell. So they called Rolf and would you drive our Porsche in Riverside, and he said no, and then he raised up the money. He said, okay, you get $100,000 and first class ticket and all the stuff, and then Rolf said, okay, one time this I'm going to drive. And then you must imagine that Derek Bell was driving first.
Yeah.
And he was coming into the pits, and they made the driver change. Rolf sat in, and on the second lap, he lost the rear wing on this Porsche, a 9556 or whatever his type is. The car went up into the air, but only a few inches, and then flew in high speed and hit the concrete. I mean, someone told me it was actually impossible
to survive.
Oh. You must imagine, he already quit racing.
Mm.
That's sad. He had quit racing. Yes. And he was from a quite wealthy family. His father had many houses in Cologne. And he was a very, very nice guy. We had so much fun. He was very often coming to Vienna. And we were going around here to the Heurigen and stuff like this. And bars and girls. And yeah. No, same with Mike Haywood. I mean, I was broken when I hear his wife called me that he got killed. A truck turned in a foggy in the mist on the highway.
Yeah,
made a U-turn. Huh?
Mm. So let's talk about some of the cars that were used in. So the cars that you used in the crash scenes, were those authentic cars or those replica cars? What were they?
No, these cars were, when the cars had a bodywork from Ferrari or from the 917 Porsche, the cars were basically a rolling chassis from Lola, from the Lola T70.
Oh, okay.
Are you familiar with that car?
Oh, yeah, Lola T70, yeah. David Piper used to have a lot of stuff to Lola's.
Take the bodywork off.
Uh-huh.
Take the bodywork off, and you have just left and right these aluminum bond tones, we call it, between the wheels.
Yep.
And then they put the bodywork from the 512 Ferrari on it, or from the 970, which then finally crashed.
Okay. And then so when you did the crash scenes, were those cars actually running, or did you use two different types of cars? So you started with were you in the cars when they crashed?
Yeah. You must imagine only the final. You know, we have one Ferrari 512 flying into the forest.
Yeah, the red one.
Yeah, the red one. And then finally down at Maison Blanche where the 970, the Michael Delaney, hit the guardrail.
Right.
You must imagine, number one, every accident, whether it's at slow speed or high speed, whether it's James Bond or Le Marfin, it takes around 3-4 weeks.
Wow.
Because you have so many different shots from the camera. Camera into the closer from the driver. Camera from the top. Camera to the back. Camera to the front. Camera right to the left. And then you must imagine you do these shots, yeah? But you manage only a couple of 2 or 3 shots per day. And then you have to take this film material to the lab in Paris. Yeah? So in the evening, you fly this material you were shooting on this day. Yeah, but only minor shots. For example, only portraits of your face looking like a race driver with a little bit dirt in your face, straight. Yeah, and then this shot, they fly in the evening to Paris, and after 3 or 4 days, this material is coming back, okay? And then we see it in a tent. You know, they have a tent with a projector and all the stuff. And then you see this, and all of a sudden, the director said, oh, we can't use it, we have to do it again. So you can imagine why I was there from April to November, late November, because when I was arriving in Vienna, it was already snow. Then it takes, but in the cinema, it's only half a second. It's only 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to have an action shot 2 seconds long, it takes 2-3 weeks. And then all of a sudden, for example, when you remember maybe you remember in this James Bond picture where the Mercedes explodes.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay, I drove the Mercedes into this wooden guardrail we prepared before, and then it dropped on the roof. Yeah.
Yeah.
This took 2 or 3 days. Yeah. So, and then came the special effect man by the name of Cez Paddock. He was an English guy who also made the special effects in Battle of England, you know, with the airplanes, Second World War. And then he put on the Mercedes, which is lying on the roof, he's putting nylon packs with kerosene in it, and then a hand drill machines.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Drill, a drill, yeah.
He put into the mud guards between the wheels,
yeah,
and switches it on that the wheels are driving, you know, because when you roll a car on the roof, the wheels are also
spinning,
rolling,
right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then action, and then he switches on the electricity, and then the wheels start to rotate, and then action, and then boom, and then he explodes these nylon bags with the kerosene in it. So what happened? Everything was happy. Everything was, because it was midnight, by minus 30 degrees. Everybody was going into the tent for some whiskey. And when after 6 days, the film was coming back, they found out that the flames and the smoke was going into the lights.
Oh.
And the whole scene was too dark.
So you had to do it again.
Do it again. So you must imagine, only to ignite this fire, it took actually 2.5 weeks.
Wow.
And Le Mans was the same. There was only a funny story. I mean, a little bit more humor when I had to hit the guardrail with a Porsche.
Yeah.
Jack Radish said, because I was talking with Steve McQueen, I said, and you know, in those days, I was 27 years old. I was a complete idiot. I said, yeah, no problem. I'm going to hit it. Yeah, flat out. Now, what should be? So, and Steve said, okay, you're coming from here. And Eric looked at that because they had placed behind the guardrail a high-speed camera. Yeah?
Yeah,
and this high-speed camera was only running 10 seconds, this big Ariflex camera. And I had to. I was coming from 300 yards, flat out speed, to hit the guardrail. Yeah? And I had a little mark that I knew where I had to hit it, because the camera was, they cut a hole into the guardrail, you know, where the objective was looking out, man? And I had to hit it. So Jack Radish was very nervous. He said, Eric, you have to hit it at 200 miles an hour and not before. And only the timing, it's only running 10 seconds because everything is gone. The car is dead, is torn. The camera will fly through the air. So if you don't hit it, there are millions of dollars gone. And I said, come on, I'll do it, no problem. And then I was continuing talking with Steve. And then Jack said, $10,000 if you hit this hole in time. And I said, I was very relaxed. And I was coming with a car full speed. And I made a little marker behind on a tree that I knew when I'm steering direct into this tree, I will hit this hole. And it was going, boom, crash, both the camera was flying through the air. And the first thing, it was going out. Everyone was like, great, beautiful, fantastic. And I was going to check Radish, $10,000.
Super, super. That's a good story. Yeah. That's a good story. Well, yeah. Eric, we got a few minutes left here. Why don't you tell us about some of the books you wrote? You've authored a few books over the years, haven't you?
Yes. I wrote my first book, 1973, mm-hmm. Motocross, Härte ohne Grenzen, Tough Without Limit. This was a book about Motocross World Championship, about the Swedish guys and the Finnish guys, some of the older generation will remember De Costa and Bengt Åberg and these guys. I knew them very well. Was writing my first book, and then later in 2005 or 2002 or something like this, I started writing books because I was old and couldn't drive anymore fast. But I drove a NASCAR test car in Charlotte.
Yeah? Oh, yeah.
5 years ago or something like this, or 8 years ago now. It was great fun because I love NASCAR. And then I was writing thrillers and also a book about my life, about the whole stories I told you now. And after that, I discussed with my publisher about Jochen Rindt, and he said, and I told him he's a German citizen, he's not an Austrian. Nah, that's not true, so please don't. I really know everything about Jochen because we nearly went into school together. And then he said, Eric, are you brave enough to write this, that he's not an Austrian citizen? And I said, yes. And when they throw me out from the country, I hope to get a job in your publishing company, maybe to clean the floor or something like this. And then I wrote the Jochen Rindt book. And for this book, I got a prize, a German prize, about the best portrait or personal portrait of the year. And also won a prize in England.
Wow.
Because this book is English-German.
Uh-huh.
You know, as a... We had an English citizen, an English professor in the gymnasium in Cologne, who made the translation very good, perfect. He's fantastic. And then I got crimes and thrillers and stuff like this.
Super. The book about yourself, your biography.
Yeah.
What's the title of that book? What's the title of it? If people want to find out about it, wie heißt das Buch?
Ja, wie heißt das Buch? Ich weiß schon. It's just Vollgas oder nichts of German. Ne? This means flat out or nothing.
Flat out or nothing. Okay. Well, you know what? That was Jochen Rindt's motto. Jochen Rindt, you know, he was flat out. I mean,
yeah,
he raised.
It starts because you must imagine in the 60 years, we were really going like mad with our cars. And if you were not traveling between Vienna and Salzburg below longer than 1.5 hours, the 300 kilometers open road, not highway, then they were getting the do word from your way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can read. The Nordautobahn zwischen Wien und Salzburg, gell? Südautobahn zwischen...
Open Road, Strengberg, and you were going.
Yeah.
I mean, with a Beamer 202,
yeah.
A tuned engine, and we were driving like mad, and Jochen was even worse. And the book starts actually with some adventures with Jochen, and then my first car then was a Steyrbuch 500, and... And Volkswagen from my mother and all these stories, you know. But this was the 60s, you know. It's like Mick Jagger was shouting, I can't get no satisfaction. You know?
All right, Eric, if people want to find out more about you, how do they go about finding out more about you? Because this has been a real treasure, a real treat having you on the show here for part one and part two. And we're just about out of time. But so if people want to find out more about Erich Glavitza, how do they go about doing it?
Yeah. Everybody can write me and Erich, E-R-I-C-H.
Erich.
Glavitza, it's George Lima Alpha Victor India Tango Zulu Alpha.
Yeah.
Glavitza @gmail.com.
Well,
everybody's
Eric,
welcome.
Everybody's welcome. Okay, so when are you going to be in the United States?
Go ahead. And are there any West Coast listeners?
Very possible, yes, because you know we're live on the internet. So yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, they should write me on the email, and I will tell them when I'm in Laguna, and we'll have some coffee.
Have a cafe, yeah. We'll go to a conditoria.
Yeah, some cafe. Yeah.
Good.
Because since 1985, the coffee is really acceptable in the United States.
Acceptable. Okay.
Before, I don't want to discuss it.
Well, you can always find an espresso or a cappuccino here somewhere.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Eric, thank you very much for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars. I truly appreciate it. It was a treat having you on the show, telling the stories about Your Majesty's Secret Service with Diana Rigg and Le Mans with Steve McQueen. That was just a real pleasure. And I wish you all the best, and I look forward to meeting you someday.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And all the best to all the Americans.
Okay. So I was just... Bye-bye. All right, I want to thank all my listeners for tuning in to Nostalgic Radio Cars. Don't forget to check us out here every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the Tantalk Radio Network. Don't forget to tell your friends to tune in as well for some of the most legendary and fascinating names in motorsports right here in downtown Clearwater on the Tantalk Radio Network. Don't forget to follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Hey, it's summertime. Get out there, ride your motorcycle, drive your boat on the water, and pick out your classic car in the evening for a nice evening drive, especially if you get a convertible. So I want to thank everybody again for tuning in. Don't forget to stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.